She then told me she was distracted by something outside the window, and just by thinking of a place she was there. It was like her mind had traveled to that point in an instant, rather than finding herself as a body floating about the room like a ghost, which wasn't the case at all. She found herself hovering above the emergency room of the hospital. She described it exactly. How the doors automatically opened, how vehicles came in from one direction and left by another. All of this I knew to be true. So I thought, maybe somebody in housekeeping pushed her bed over by the window, which was above the emergency room, in order to clean the floor. This was a dumb idea because someone in housekeeping would have to disconnect a critically ill patient from all this machinery to move her bed. It just wouldn't happen. Plus there's a roof that separated the line of vision from the active area of the emergency room that she was describing. I didn't take any of that into account. I was desperately searching for a way to explain what she was telling me. Then, she said she was further distracted by an object on the third floor of the building, but in a different part of the hospital. That was the real reason she was upset. She wanted me to go find this object. It was a tennis shoe and she wanted me to get it. I only wanted to go home. This was weird. Because she was so sincere, I wanted to believe her, but there was my rational academic medical side that said, this can't be happening. I couldn't believe it. To calm the patient, Kim went outside and looked up at the hospital from the car park. She could see nothing on any window ledge. She almost gave up, but decided to walk around the third floor on the off chance. I went from room to room. The windows were narrow and so I had to really press my face against the glass to look down and see the ledge at all. I was thinking I wasn't going to find the shoe, then I looked down and found the shoe. It was an incredible, jarring experience. I had some choices to make. I could at this point believe Maria was a hummingbird. I ruled that out. I could believe Maria had somehow gone into a tall, downtown building half a mile away, gained access to an upper office, had high-powered binoculars or a telescope, and had spotted this tennis shoe on the ledge. All this, in case she had a heart attack and was admitted to that particular hospital. That didn't make any sense either. I was right back to thinking Maria was a hummingbird. Or I could believe that Maria, when I witnessed her death, was out of her body and traveled clear around the corner of the building and up a floor and was able to describe to me an object as small as this shoe. She had given me details, the shoe was scruffy and the lace was under the heel. I knew that was true. But she didn't tell me at the time what color the shoe was. Well, after I got over my shock, I reached out of the window and pulled the shoe up. I hightailed it back to the coronary care unit, but I put the shoe behind my back. I walked into the room more calmly than I was really feeling and I asked Maria to describe the shoe again. For the first time I asked what color it was. She said blue. I was holding a blue tennis shoe and I asked her again about the appearance and she said, the lace was tucked under the heel and the side of the shoe was scruffed up. And then, rather dramatically, I pulled the shoe from behind my back. She was elated and so grateful. We were just swept away by the emotion of it and embraced in sheer joy. I had no choice but to believe that this woman, by all accounts dead, had been out of her body that was no longer functioning. Right then my whole perspective about life and death shifted. Maria was really my great teacher. Maria returned to her life as a migrant crop picker and for 4 years wrote to Kim at regular intervals. Suddenly, the letters stopped and Kim Clark Sharp believes Maria is dead. I had no way of reaching her because of her lifestyle, but she would find me and then it stopped. My sense is that she is deceased because she was very good about keeping in touch. Kim's life was altered by meeting Maria. She became a member of Dr. Morse's Seattle Study Research Team and now leads the Seattle chapter of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. Every month about 70 people meet to talk about their near-death experiences. These will mostly be first-hand brushes with death, but I doubt if any will be such a challenge to orthodox explanations of near-death experiences as Kim's story of the shoe on the ledge, which strongly suggests a sighted out-of-body experience and not an hallucination. One aspect bothered me: what was a tennis shoe doing out on a window ledge in the first place? I went to see the actual window where the shoe was found, now part of office accommodation but then a hospital ward. The sun was warm on the side of the building and the answer seemed clear. If your canvas shoe was wet, if it had fallen into a bath or bowl of water, that window ledge was a perfect place to dry it in the sun. Only an old shoe, it was forgotten or abandoned, until it was found by a woman having a near-death experience and became an enigma of modern medicine. Chapter 8, The Vietnam Veteran, Truth Sits Upon the Lips of Dying Men, Matthew Arnold. An American soldier, severely wounded in a Viet Cong attack on the United States forward base in the Vietnam War in 1965, had a dramatic and classic near-death experience. Toughened down to earth, Dave Cook lost his left leg in a surprise night raid and was on the brink of death. It changed his outlook on life. Listening to Dave's compelling narrative in August 1990 was an almost surreal experience. His story of a hail of mortar shells was told against the backdrop of the charred ruins of his burned-out home, which had caught fire a few days earlier due to a fault in a heating system. An hour's drive from Seattle, we seemed almost back in the rubble of Vietnam in 1965. Behind us was the blackened shell of Dave's house and over our heads, the stars and stripes flew from his personal flagpole. In this bizarre but appropriate setting, he told his story as if it had happened yesterday. The tale began with a precognitive dream he had in October 1965, a month before he lost his leg. Asleep in South Vietnam, he imagined he was back in America, at the Oakland Army Terminal, confronting a crowd of anti-war demonstrators. He was gripping a Colt .45 revolver in his left hand, and then he noticed there were crutches under his arms. His left leg was missing. He didn't take the dream seriously and a month later was at a frontline base. The next day, 21 November, was my birthday. So me and two other guys went downtown for a party and we had a ball. Anyway, I was tired so I went to bed. I was sound asleep when I heard a round being dropped down the tube of a mortar. It was clanking as it went down the barrel and I heard when it hit the firing mechanism. I heard the round come back up out of the tube, a faster trajectory, and I sat straight up in bed, sober as a judge. I sat there and I heard where the round exploded. I recalled the old man telling me, "Dave, if you ever get under a firefight like this, run for the closest fortified bunker." That flashed right in front of me. I waited for the next round that was in the same area, so I knew which way to run, and I took off. The third round hit in the same area, so I said, "Well, you're doing good, you're safe." Then I was running down the long crushed gravel walkway, and the fourth round came over the top of my head. It was in a position where you feel you could reach up and grab it, it was that close. I heard the sound of the clicking of the fins in the back. They say, as long as you can hear that, you're safe. But when you don't hear it, you have to look out because it's coming down. Well, that round went past me. But for some unknown reason I passed it when I ran around the corner. I could see the fortified bunker about 12 feet in front of me, just the silhouette of it. I heard no more sound and I turned and looked and 6 feet away the round hit. And everything at that point seemed to go into slow motion. I could see the rocks, the colors of them, and then a hole just started to open up in the ground and things were just lazily going through the air. The next I remember is I hit the top of the bunker, right here on my buttocks, and I fell over onto the bunker. Wow, what's going on here? And I threw myself forward, slid down and hit the ground. Another round came in and hit just a few feet from the other one. I seen my friend. He took off, and went sailing into the darkness. So I said, "Gee whiz, he needs medical aid." So I started to crawl over there. But at the same time I seen what had happened to me, the whole ground in front of me was red, my knee section from here to here was gone, except for 4 tendons and 1 nerve. Other guys came running in, and they'd kick the leg I'd lost into my lap. I'd throw it off. They kicked me in the face accidentally and this whole side was bruised from them getting into the bunker. The next thing I remember, I was lying down and the exec officer said, "Give me a belt for a tourniquet." I'd lost so much blood, I was in convulsions and I lost my eyesight from bleeding to death. At that point in time, I began having this near-death experience. I could see my life, from when I was born, I could see it in vivid technicolor, the purest colors that you could ever possibly imagine. It just went right in front of my eyes, until the present day. After I went through my life, there was a long black tunnel, which I presumed was square or a rectangle because the light at the end was in a square. It was way down at the other end and it was pure white. As it proceeded down this tunnel, the rays at the end started projecting out, beautiful rays, and everything was peaceful and quiet. As I entered this chamber, I felt you'd have to squint because of the brightness of the light, but it wasn't in that fashion. It was so pure of a white, you just look all around you and it was 360 degrees around me. And there was no spoken words or anything at this point in time, but my answer to what I perceived was a question to me. Did I want to stay there? Was that I screamed, "No, I want to see my son." And that's when I was back, when the company exec officer yelled to the sergeant to give him a belt for a tourniquet. Then they took me to the field hospital. There was one happy sequel to Dave's near-death experience. A few weeks later, on the 8th of December 1965, the baby Dave and his wife had been expecting was born. It was a boy, as he'd anticipated in his near-death experience. Dave spoke about the effect the experience had on him. "What the experience tells me is there is life after death and that it is peaceful. To tell you the truth, I'm no longer fearful of it. It changed my way of thinking of life too. I'm now a supervisor in a shipyard, so I have 90 employees working for me, and I pay attention to their personal problems. I used to be a hothead. I'm no longer that way. I reason things out. Rather than hit someone, I think about it first. I respect life very much. It has made a better person out of me." Chapter 9. Sea Changes. A drowning man's life flashes before his eyes. Folklore of the Sea. A New York artist, whose studio overlooks the waterfront, paradoxically found only self-awareness and inspiration when she nearly drowned at sea in the aftermath of a hurricane. Anne Shaw, a talented painter, was a 16-year-old schoolgirl when she disappeared under the waves. Her brief life flashed before her eyes as the prelude to a classic near-death experience. A black tunnel leading to a beautiful garden, angels and a voice that told her to go back. There was even a presence, which seemed to guide the drowning girl to the shore. It was a religious experience that changed the schoolgirl's life. She became an art student, then a dedicated painter, consciously drawing upon a new inner harmony, a dimension of meaning she felt was revealed in her mystical near-death encounter. But there are thousands other similar ones. Only occasionally do the actual images of her drowning experience find their way onto canvas. Her near-death experience made her aware of dimensions of space and time. For appropriate images, she looked not into the sea, but to space travel. The fascination is so real that Anne Sharp applied to become an astronaut, but was turned down. Her paintings indicate she managed in a sense to get there anyway. The most exciting journeys take place in the mind, and she paints planets and stars, juxtaposed with perceptions about people. Anne's near-death experience began near her home on the New Jersey shore. It was the season for hurricanes, the sea was running high and the beach was closed. Not surprisingly, the girl who wanted to become an astronaut was not deterred. "I had just got my senior lifeguard badge, so I really thought I was a great swimmer. And I looked at this incredible surf coming in and I thought it must be like California. I said to three of the boys at the beach, 'Let's go in and go surfing.' I started going under the waves and coming up. I thought this was just great. There is a certain point usually where you can get beyond the waves, but somehow that point never quite came. I was getting a little tired and I looked back to see where the boys were and, of course, they weren't there. Even then I really wasn't afraid. I said, 'Oh well, they're not a lifeguard. so I kept going under the waves and I was getting breathless. I really got tired and I was thrown under the water and disoriented. I didn't know which way was up. There were rocks and sand and my bailing cap was torn off. I didn't know how far I could keep going under these enormous waves. Then all of a sudden I noticed a flash, like my whole little life was being shown to me. I was only 15 but I saw this sort of film, but it was somehow in a circle. I heard noises and didn't know what was happening. I heard church bells, crickets and a whoosh, like the wind. I didn't feel any pain. The next thing I know, it's real dark, and I'm afraid of the darkness. Just black, velvety black, and then there was this long tunnel. Not all black, with little lights like galaxies, and then it was very bright, like honey color, clear but not sticky. It was like a bright, warm feeling and I looked and saw very calm water going into this beautiful garden. There were two angels and some people I didn't know. It was wonderful. I'd never seen anything like it and I forgot where I was and everything. Then a voice said, "Go back." I was always an indecisive person and the voice said, "Go back. You have a wonderful life. You have to tell people things." I didn't have any choice, and then there was a blinding flash of bright, white light, not like the yellow, golden light. All of a sudden, like putting a jacket on, I felt myself back in the ocean. I looked up and it was still foggy. I turned toward shore and it was as though someone was helping me. I just swam very easily all the way. I've never been that calm before or since. It was so warm and loving. At the end, one of the boys reached out to grab me, screaming that I'd been gone so long. I backed away and then he grabbed me and kind of slapped my face. When I came out of the water, I just was so overwhelmed by the experience that I didn't really want to tell anyone. I felt something really different had happened to me. I didn't dare tell my parents either, although I told my father I had a close call in the water. I was afraid that under the water maybe something happened to my brain. I did tell someone I had a wonderful experience and they looked at me like I was crazy. It was a terrible thing, you almost drowned. My whole personality really changed, because from being aimless, just drifting, I really became focused on going away to New York and becoming an artist. I knew this was what I had to do and it would all come out all right. It also made me much more tolerant of all types of people. Before I was a very difficult child. I always had to have my own way. Now I became a bit more mellow and tolerant, and just wanting to see the whole world. I had a feeling of harmony that I never had, which is the most important thing. In relation to time and space, I began to see everything existing at once. I also found I believed in Jung's theory of synchronicity, when certain things and events come together. My belief is that it's always happening. The part of the experience that really got to me was this feeling of space and time being one in a whole other dimension. I don't care what the scientists say. I may have other fears, might be neurotic, but I have never questioned there's life after death. I don't mean life as we know it, but a whole different existence, and I got as far as being in this wonderful light. Now I know, the more I read, that this will happen to everybody, no matter how bad the illness or how sudden. I read some Eastern quote that death is just like changing your jacket. And that's one fear I actually don't have, the fear of death. One time I almost got caught out when I heard somebody had this near-death experience and I said, "How lucky he is to get to die twice," and I laughed. People were shocked and that's why I felt it was best to hold back on saying some of these things in public. I laughed because it was a joyous experience, the happiest I frankly ever had, except in maybe trying to do my work. Sometimes in life and death situations where I've been around someone who is near death, I can find this light again, which gives me this feeling of warmth and harmony, and it takes away the fear of losing someone. A New York man, whose apparently lifeless body was dragged from the sea after a scuba diving mishap, witnessed his own despairing efforts to reach the shore from a strange vantage point, high up in the air, hovering out of body, above the drama. Today, Years after the incident, John Migliaccio is convinced his near-death experience was much more than an hallucination in a dying brain. He is sure he was truly out of body because, from above the shoreline, he saw parts of the coast he had never seen before. His narrow escape from death in the sea off New Jersey was in many ways a typical near-death experience, although he describes traveling through blackness at great speed, instead of journeying down a black tunnel. He feels his life has been changed by this experience. "I don't even care if people believe me or not. I know it was as real as anything else, and no other experience has made so much impact. People are right to question these experiences, and I spent 10 years myself trying to be skeptical about it. But I couldn't come up with any conclusion other than that it happened and was real." He was 18 years old when his ordeal began. He was scuba diving on his own and ran out of there. In his wetsuit, oxygen cylinder strapped to his back, he decided to swim towards a jetty on the shore. He soon recognized a problem. A strong ebb tide was pushing him away from the shore. "After swimming for quite a long time, I looked to some sight points I had made on the jetty and found I hadn't gotten very far, which didn't faze me. I just keep swimming and swimming. I just kept trying to go against the current until I realized I was exhausted. My arms felt like lead weights. As I was swimming, I suddenly found myself looking down at my body from a few hundred feet up. I could see myself in my wetsuit, the scuba equipment on my back. The first thought was, how can this be happening? It was the strangest thing I had ever experienced. Because not only did I see myself swimming, but I realized in my body that I was looking down at myself. It was like being in two places at once. I thought, this is impossible, like having a separate set of eyes, a separate thinking apparatus and being in two places at once. When that thought occurred, I saw myself close up, as vivid as day. Then I popped back up high. My body was about the size of my thumb, a little black thing down in the water swimming. It was a very enjoyable piece. I recall silly things. The blue of the sky still makes my mouth water, it was so blue. The fluffiness of the clouds, like cotton up in the sky. I had a view up and down the coast and a view inland to trees and other areas. The thing that convinced me this was really happening was that I could see both sides of the jetty. I had only seen one side of it as I was walking down to the beach, but from in the sky I could see the other side, I could see the beach. It was extremely pleasant to be able to experience it all without a body, as if one brain was in two places. This lasted a few minutes and then I was back down in my body swimming. For the first time I became very afraid for my physical safety, because I heard myself breathing and what was coming out of me was grunting. It was just scary and I thought to stop swimming and try and make an emergency signal, but I decided if I stopped swimming I would drown right there. So I began to tell myself, keep swimming, don't panic. I was probably 50 to 60 yards at least from the shore and I just completely blacked out. I have no recollection of any physical movement. The next thing I recall is the flipper of my left foot touched something solid, just brushed the sands. And I kind of woke up, and lifted my head up out of the water to see where I was. I apparently had swum all the way up to the beach, and as I lifted my head up, with my mouth open, a wave just caught me right in the face and I was breathing sea water. Everything went black, but I still knew what was going on. I had a sense of a voice, simply something that communicated to me, "It's okay, don't worry, everything's going to be all right." Which I consciously resisted. The second time that happened, I simply stopped resisting this information and then I started traveling. It's the only way I can put it. Going at 20 zillion miles an hour, straight up through dense blackness. It was completely black and different from the blackout prior to that, because I knew what was going on. I was aware of traveling so fast, and I had a sense there was a boundary out there somewhere. Although I couldn't see it, couldn't feel it, couldn't touch it. I just knew out on the horizon there was a boundary through this blackness. I reached one point, and the only way I can describe it is that I felt I was a firework going off, and connecting with everything that there was in terms of information. Everything made sense. The whole universe made sense. I felt the connection between myself and everything else that ever existed. The old saying about the entire universe is contained in a grain of sand. It was like the grain of sand and the universe both shared the same consciousness. It's like knowing about everything that's out there, feeling extremely at peace, not excited, and accepting all that was happening. I remember kind of looking back and not really looking back, but just becoming aware of being outside Earth and seeing a pinpoint of light, very, very far away in this blackness. I heard a voice say, "He must have panicked," as if you overhear a comment about you as you're walking very quickly down the street, and they're passing the other way. It was like I was turning round saying, "No, I didn't panic." As soon as I said that, bam, I was back down in my body. I felt like a rugby ball in the middle of a scrum with all these people and voices. I didn't see anything, I just heard a bunch of people around me, looking down, and then heard somebody say, "He made a noise, he's going to be all right." About 2 days after the experience, a doctor came in who actually had taken care of me in the emergency room. He sat down and said, "You know, you're very lucky. You were dead. They couldn't find any pulse and you weren't breathing when they got you out of the water." I tried to tell him that very strange things had happened and he said, "Don't worry about it, you're okay now." So I treated the experience almost as if it was an hallucination or something, but it would never let me go. Finally, 10 years after I had the experience, I talked to someone else who had one. His experience was even more unbelievable. "What does it mean and why me? Why did I come back? A lot of people die and never come back and a lot of people die, are revived and don't have a near-death experience. The important changes in me did not come in any dramatic way. I haven't become a saint, I have not gone out and devoted myself to good works. It comes in very small decisions you make every day. A difference is there's no fear of being dead. And if you're really not afraid of that, there's not much else to be afraid of in your life. It gives you a frame of reference. The absolute love that's out there makes you much more concerned about everything else in the universe. It makes you concerned about trying to be the best person you can possibly be." Chapter 10. Seattle Studies. Death opens unknown doors. John Masfield. In Seattle, a middle-aged woman told us she'd been out of body 3 times, the first when she was struck by a heavy piece of furniture at the age of 2. But a young man went one better. He had a near-death experience and found himself crawling up a black tunnel towards a bright light, when he was only 9 months old. There was corroboration for this teenager's remarkable story from his parents, who were both convinced he had had this experience at the age of 9 months. Medical records confirmed he was desperately ill in a coma at that time. Mark's near-death experience has been studied by Dr. Melvin Morse, who said, "At first, most people are skeptical about this story of a 9-month-old child apparently crawling to heaven. They ask if it is possible for a child that young to remember a near-death experience. The answer is yes." Dr. Morse said research showed that learning and memory begin earlier than had been thought. 7-month-old infants were shown a video demonstrating how a toy was fitted together, and afterwards they were able to put it together themselves. Another group of 7-month-olds were not shown the video and they found it impossible to assemble the toy. Our television team met Mark and his parents as part of a day visiting people who had experienced near-death experiences in the Seattle area. Our guide was Shannon Greer, researcher with the Seattle Study, the group set up by Dr. Morse which analyzed data about near-death experiences in children. In 1986, Dr. Morse published the group's findings in the American Journal of Diseases of Children, and came to several important conclusions. Near-death experiences didn't seem to happen to children who were simply seriously ill, they had to be close to death. In 121 seriously ill children, no near-death experiences were reported. But of 12 children who had been close to death, 8 said they had left their bodies and traveled to another realm. These near-death experiences were not caused by drugs or hallucinations due to lack of oxygen. to Dr. Morse's irritation. As a result of this study, he was turned down for a grant to make a similar study with children of Asian parents, a chance to compare the results for different cultures.